which means the evil eye. And it is something that I think everyone in the world is aware of and is afraid of. We feel that there is some influence in the world known as the evil eye, which people are always trying to ward off. And I think that most of us view it as a mystical force, and which is absolutely incorrect in terms of Torah knowledge. And Rabbi Soloveitchik presented it very beautifully through the use of a Gemara. And it's a very interesting Gemara because it says that Rabbi Yochanan would go and sit in front of the gates of the mikvah. And when women would come up after they were done with the immersion, they would look at him and they would hope to have children as beautiful as he was. And so the sages asked him, aren't you afraid of an evil eye? Aren't you afraid of an ayin hara? And the interesting problem that we have here is that, I don't know if you're aware of this, but every month when the woman is done with her menses, she immerses herself in the mikvah, something like that baptismal font you showed me in the front of your place when I was down there. But normally it's done with a great deal of modesty. It's something that even women amongst themselves don't discuss, you know, when they are going to go to the mikvah. It's something that deals with, you know, the relationship between the husband and wife. So at first, anyone who's aware of this situation is kind of amazed that a man would actually be sitting in front of the mikvah. It doesn't really make very much sense. And then, of course, this whole idea of his being beautiful and women gazing upon him and hoping to have children like him, it doesn't fall in line with our way of thinking. And so this really needs a little bit of clarification. And the first part that the Gemara deals with is, what is this beauty of Rabbi Yochanan? What is it exactly that we're talking about? Because we know that we don't put a lot of emphasis on the idea of physical beauty. And so the Gemara goes on, and it gives you somewhat of a metaphor, some kind of a description, and it says that if you wanted to understand how beautiful this man really was, what you should do is take a brand new silver cup and fill it with the seeds of a pomegranate and lay on the rim of this cup a beautiful garland of red roses. And take this cup full of the beautiful red seeds and the garland of roses and place it in the light. And as the rays of the light hit this cup and reflect on the silver and the colors in it, you'll have a little bit of a description of what the beauty of Rabbi Yochanan was. And Rabbi Soloveitchik says that this tale, this Agada, needs a little bit of interpretation, because when Chazal, when the sages talk about beauty, obviously they're not discussing the physical beauty of a person. We don't talk about the straight nose, and we don't talk about the pouty lips. We don't describe a person in this manner. We don't. That's not important to us. What the rabbis mean by the beauty, I guess that's my husband, what the rabbis call beauty is in essence the knowledge of a person. And in Hebrew we say, Chachmat Adam Toyir Panav, that the knowledge of a person is what brightens up the person's face, that there is the beauty of a person which is empty. You look at the person's face and you think, like I say to my kids, you look at people on television and you say, wow, the guy is so good looking, she's so good looking. And then when you get to meet these people, they're very boring, very empty, they have nothing to contribute. And then you take a look at the beauty of Rabbi Yochanan, and that beauty is one which reflects knowledge, which reflects depth, kindness, understanding. And so what we're talking about with the beauty of Rabbi Yochanan that these women gazed upon was the beauty of the knowledge that came from this man. But it still doesn't satisfy the question of what was this very intelligent man doing outside of the mikveh, if going to the mikveh is supposed to be something that is conducted in a modest manner. As a matter of fact, it's interesting that if a woman's time to go to the mikveh is from Friday night, she's permitted to do so. And very often you'll find that the husbands will walk their women to the mikveh, and it's almost unwritten law that he waits for her down the block, because we always conduct this in a very modest way. So the point that he stood outside of the mikveh, it seems very strange. And the rabbis explain it in a very interesting manner. They say that when the women would go to the mikveh, this would be, you know, the time that they would think in terms of family life, conception, child raising. I mean, this whole experience of the mikveh is tied up in Jewish family life. And Rabbi Yochanan, what he did was, he was a man with exceptional abilities, and he believed that every child was a gift from God. And so what he did was, he sat outside of the mikveh where women were able to come to him and talk about child raising, talk about the problems of their young, and he would sit and it says that he was a man of very few words, because we know that a person who's knowledgeable does not have to go into a lengthy discourse in order for you to understand what they have to say. And that's exactly what he did. He sat with the women, he spoke to them, and he helped inspire them to go home and to raise their children in a Torah lifestyle. So this was the effect that Rabbi Yochanan had, and the beauty was not a physical beauty, but it was the knowledge and the inspiration that he was able to give to these women as they left the mikveh with the ideas of their family in their mind. But the interesting part is that when the rabbi said to him, well, aren't you afraid of an ayin hara? We know that, I don't know how, you know, you guys view it, but I know that in you know, Jewish circles, it's very common for Jewish grandmothers to try to ward off evil eyes, especially on their beautiful brides or grandchildren, by pinning little red ribbons and such underneath their clothing and whatnot, because they feel that they must do something to ward off this evil spirit. And yet when they asked Rabbi Yochanan, aren't you afraid of an ayin hara, of an evil eye, his response was very unusual. And he said, I am not afraid of an evil eye, because I come from the family of Joseph. And evil eyes do not befall the family of Joseph. And he quotes a pasuk in the Torah, which is from Genesis 49:22, and it says, Joseph is a fruitful son, like a fruitful vine, by the fountain with branches running over the wall. And he makes that statement, which I'll explain in just a minute, to imply that because he is from the family of Joseph, evil eyes cannot befall him. And yet what we find very strange about this is that there was no way that he could possibly have known at that point in time that he was actually a descendant from the family of Joseph, because that information was lost to them. So we need to draw a relationship between Rabbi Yochanan and Joseph. What was the similarity between the two of them, which would mean that just as Yosef would not be the receiver of an evil eye, so would this Rabbi Yochanan not be a person who would be able to receive the evil eye? And then it goes on to explain that when Jacob blessed the children of Joseph, who were Manasseh and Ephraim, he said to them, and I looked this up in English too, so hang on for 1 second. This is Bereishis, it's Genesis 48:16 says, hang on 1 second, guys. 48. Jacob gave Joseph a blessing, and he said, the God before whom my fathers Abraham and Isaac walked is the God who has been my shepherd from as far back as I can remember until this day, sending an angel to deliver me from all evil. May he bless the lads and let them carry my name along with the names of my fathers, Abraham and Isaac. May they increase in the land like fish. Now, the reason that we say that the family of Joseph is not going to be able to receive the evil eye is because they are, in this blessing of Jacob, compared to fish. And we know that there is a unique characteristic to a fish, and that is they multiply rapidly, and they live underneath the surface of the water, which would imply that there is some barrier between the fish and humanity. Obviously, people cannot affect the fish in some adverse way, and so they are able to multiply. So we have some indication about the relationship between the family of Joseph and Evil Eye, but it's still not very clear to us. And then another explanation is offered through the word eye, and that is that when Joseph was approached by the wife of Potiphar and she tried to seduce him, he said that, "I do not want to take anything that does not belong to me," meaning the wife of my master. And so Rashi tells us that, or the Gemara actually tells us, because of this he was given the reward, or he was rewarded with the fact that an evil eye would not befall him. And so we need to draw a parallel between Rabbi Yochanan, who said, "I am of the descendants of Joseph and cannot receive an evil eye," and Joseph himself. And the common denominator between these two people was that they both were unaffected by what other people thought of them. In other words, if you've been following the weekly portions, you are going to be very aware of the fact that we have been dealing with Joseph and Joseph's personality. And we know that the brothers absolutely never had a good word to say about this young lad. First of all, they hated him because he was a talebearer. They hated him because his father singled him out and rewarded him with this coat of many colors. They hated him because he had this dream, not one dream, but two dreams, which implied that he was going to be the master over them. And we know that in a normal situation, we know also that when his father sent him to find how the brothers were doing, he was in great conflict because he knew his brothers didn't like him. And it tells us in the Chumash that he got lost, and he needed the assistance of an angel to help him find his way. And what was unusual about this is his becoming lost was really a conflict. He didn't want to go because he knew his brothers hated him. And when they saw him approaching, they said, "Oh, here's the dreamer. Here's the lad who's coming." And so they plotted and schemed against him, and they sold him, as you all know, threw him in the pit, sold him into a caravan, and they thought that this was the end of this person. And in reality, an average person would probably have been so totally destroyed by people who plotted against him in this manner that would have destroyed him. And yet we find that Joseph surfaces, he becomes prominent. What was it what ability, what characteristic did he have that allowed him to overcome all of this? And Rabbi Soloveitchik says that there are two characteristics in a person. Either a person can have ga'ava, which means ego, and an evaluation of himself which is not really in reality, or he can have what is called ge'ut. And in our prayers we say Hashem Melech Ge'ut. God is a God of majesty. Ge'ut really means that he is the person that knew the qualities that he had, and he was totally unaffected by anyone else. Joseph knew his intrinsic worth, and he had the courage to be successful in Egypt. And even as a slave in someone's house, he knew who he was. And that's what we say was the common denominator between Joseph and Rabbi Yochanan. That when they said to Rabbi Yochanan, "Aren't you afraid of an evil eye?" he said, "No, I am not, because I come from the family of Joseph." And he was not affected by the judgment of other people. You know, I said to my kids, people would look at a man sitting outside, in our society, they would look at a man sitting outside of the mikveh, and they'd say, "That guy's a pervert. What is he doing out there watching all the women coming and going?" But that was not the reality. This was a man who had great knowledge to impart to women. And you know that when you meet a great person, you walk away totally inspired. I mean, for days, you're imbued with the ideas that this man had to share with us. And all great sages of Israel are this way. When people, when our great people have to pass on a law, or if they have to make what we call a pesach in halacha, they have to make a judgment call on a certain law. When they do it with the knowledge, the security of their knowledge, and they're not concerned about what other people, feel about them. So we find that we begin to get a picture of what Ayin Hara is. It is being subject to the estimation of other people. And the interesting thing is that in Hebrew, we could actually change the word a bit, and we could say Ayin Hara or Ayin Ra'ah. Now, if we say Ayin Ra'ah, it means an eye that is bad. If we say Ayin Hara, we interpret it to mean the eye of the one who is bad. And I just want to, make a little distinction with that. When we say Ayin Ra'ah, what we're talking about is kind of a person who's stingy. He has a bad eye. He can't give of him of his property. He's not the most giving of people. He's the kind of person that might do you a favor faster than he would give of something of value to him. As a matter of fact, on Yom Kippur, when we go through the list of transgressions, one of the transgressions that we ask forgiveness for is on what we call Tzarut Ha'ayin, which means the fact that a person is very tight. That would be a description of Lot's wife, the woman who could not run next door to get a little bit of salt, a person who has to, hold back. They have a bad eye. It doesn't mean that the person himself is bad. It means there are certain characteristics in the person that is bad. And that's not what we're dealing with. We are dealing with Ayin Hara, the eye of the bad person. And really, what is the definition in this case of a person that is bad? It's very simple. It exists in our society today. It's someone who cannot stand to see somebody else be successful. And usually when we see someone who is successful, they will never attribute it to the person himself. They'll say, well, he got a lucky break. His father left him a couple of buildings. He's a millionaire because his grandmother died. They will never, ever look at this person and estimate him properly. They will always attribute this person's ability to something else. And what happens is people become affected by how other people view them. And when people view you in a certain manner, then what happens is it kind of does a number on you. And I'll give you a very good example. In other words, I may be giving this class, and then before it's over, I may hear somebody say, she wasn't really all that good. And so I'll never want to do this again, because my self-worth is being judged by you people. And most people in our society are dependent on what other people think and say about them. So what you're really saying to a person when you say, oh, don't give me the evil eye, is you're really saying, don't evaluate me, because I am dependent on your evaluation. Your evaluation is going to tell me whether I am worth anything. Yosef did not need anyone to evaluate him as a person. He knew his abilities and he knew who he was, or his brothers would have brought him down immediately. So we find, I'm probably going to finish before the hour is over. Are you going to fire me? Hello?
No, we're not going to fire you.
Okay, I didn't know. Suddenly I thought perhaps this whole thing got blocked out.
Yeah, you've been talking to the air, and I hate to tell you this.
But?
I think this will be your last class.
That's good. It's my only one.
When you said that, everybody in here just laughed. You know, they're barely laughing.
They all laughed. I can't hear a thing happening on the other end. I guess I'm better off.
Yeah, so we keep you close. That drives the rabbi crazy because we keep him blocked off so that we don't interfere.
Oh, okay. That's all right.
And so we're thinking about having a poster like, you know, a life-size poster to stand in front of him to look at while he's talking.
Oh, well, you know, I'll tell you the truth. I don't really mind. I'm so used to talking to myself anyway. It doesn't make a difference. But anyway, the next thing that I wanted to mention was the situation of why should a person try to avoid the evil eye, okay? And there's a very interesting Gemara. The Gemara says that 99% of people die because of an ayin hara, and only 1% of the population dies because of natural death. Now, it's really a crazy-sounding Gemara, but what it really means is that a person should not make himself haughty. Because when a person makes himself haughty, then everyone begins to envy him. If a person is in the limelight, then people are more than happy to try to destroy this person. When Alexander the Great met the sages, and he asked them for the secret to life, they said to him, make yourself small. And the reason is because if people are envious, then they want to destroy you. And recently, in the last year or two, we had a lot going on in New York City with Donald Trump. And he was just a haughty son of a gun, and he was in the papers, and everything that had his name on it implied his sense of value, his haughtiness. And really what happened to this person is people began to go after him. And the feeling was, we're going to get the son of a gun. And we had another situation where there was Leona Helmsley. And she made one fatal mistake. She was the woman who ran the Helmsley Hotel, the palace. She presented herself as queen of the palace. And she said, well, only little people are going to pay taxes. And we say that what condemned her was not so much her crime, but her haughtiness, her character. And that's what the sages mean when they say that people died because of I and her. A person who is haughty is going to be brought down by people because people cannot stand the haughtiness. So avoid that at all costs. And then finally, the Gemara goes into a very interesting psychological message, and it says that you should not go into a person's field at the time of harvest to see what a person has earned. And we translate that to mean that you're not supposed to, if you go into someone's house and see their bank book sitting on the table, look inside the bank book. Why? Because that causes you to become envious. And then what happens is when you become envious of a person, you have a chance to help that person. You may not want to help them because here's my family. Because you won't want to because you're going to envy him, and this envy is going to cause him harm. So a person who keeps a low-keyed image and a person who stays in a situation where he's not haughty is going to be a person who's going to be in that 1%, and he's not going to die because of ayin hara. Now, there is an interesting... Okay. There's an interesting story that says that... now, the second part of the story, which says that Joseph was the person who did not take something that did not belong to him. When he had the opportunity to take the wife of Potiphar, he did not take what didn't belong to him. And so, therefore, he was rewarded by not being the recipient of an evil eye. Explains another aspect of Ayin Hara to us. It says that people are often very envious of famous people. Because when you look at a famous person, you think, well, this person can do anything that he wants to. And, if I could only just be like him, I'd have all of my wishes fulfilled, everything that I wanted. But if they see that this person restricts himself in some manner, then all the fantasies that you attach to this person are removed. And therefore, the person cannot be the recipient of the evil eye. Now, the story is very clear when you look at the meeting of Jacob and of Esau. We know that Jacob was very afraid of meeting this brother who he had not seen in so many years, because when they left, Esau was ready to kill him. And Jacob was going to come with his wives, with his children, with his servants, with this fortune that he had amassed in the 20 years that he lived in Laban's house. And so as they met, And he was afraid that Esau was going to see this great wealth and envy him and hate him and want to destroy him. The first thing that he said to him was, I lived with Laban for the last 20 years, and I kept 613 mitzvot. And suddenly, Esau, who thought of Jacob as this powerful man who had amassed all of this wealth and who he had all of this fantasy attached to, realized that this man restricted himself. He controlled himself. He served God. He kept the mitzvot. And he was not into all of this fantasy that Esau had built up. And so there was no more envy anymore for this person who had lived a righteous life, one where he kept the 613 mitzvot. And the same thing with Joseph. When Joseph had the opportunity to take Potiphar's wife and to have her, he too saw the image of his father, who told him that he was going to be part of this whole heritage of Judaism. And he said, how can I do this? How can I destroy the whole heritage and the promise of God? And so he restrained himself. And so this is the person who is not going to be the recipient of the evil eye, because once a person restrains himself and there's no haughtiness attached to him, then the whole myth is dispelled. Okay. Now, one final thing that you really must remember in terms of the evil eye is that we say that God rewards those people who are just, and he punishes those people who deserve to be punished. Okay? Now, if we believe this statement, then we would know that nowhere is there any mention at all in the entire Bible that a person must be careful of the evil eye. And so we know that it is God who is the one who is just, and it is God who gives us what we deserve. And there is no other force in this universe who is able or capable in any way to interfere with God's justice. And God is the only one who rewards and punishes. This is the ultimate system of justice, and there is no other force at all in this universe. And man should simply be concerned with his relationship to God and fulfilling the mitzvahs. And if you know that that is what you've done correctly, then you would not even think in your wildest dreams that there is another force that abounds in this universe that people refer to as the evil eye. And I hope, I know I only did half time, but I'm just a pinch hitter. I hope that that I got my message across, and I'd be more than happy to try to answer any questions that anybody has.
Okay, we'll see if anybody's got any. Anybody got a question?
I did just want to add one funny fact. I don't know, maybe you can help me with this, but it's a very common practice in order to ward off the evil eye to wear something red. And very often you'll see people with red bows on their rear view mirrors, or if any of you have been to Israel to the grave of Rachel, there are people that give red ribbons and red wool to wrap around your hands. And my husband was reading either Time or Newsweek when Noriega was put into jail, and they reported that he was wearing red underwear. And when they asked him why, he said it was to ward off the evil eye. So the only thing that I could imagine is perhaps as Jews wandered through different countries, they must have picked up some of these primitive practices. But it's really mind-boggling to see that that this concept of red warding off the evil spirit seems to abound throughout many of the civilizations. Anybody down there know any customs about the color of red warding off the evil eye?
I don't think everybody's shaking their heads around you. I've never heard that. And
you've never heard of it?
Never heard of it.
Do you guys have evil eyes down in Tennessee?
Do we have evil eyes in Tennessee? We've got some women that's got some pretty bad eyes. But we send them to the optometrist and he usually clears them up.
What?
Does it protect the daughters? Would it protect the daughters? Now, see, this seems to be
too quickly. You know, when you feel more relaxed, you can kind of, you know, expand and mm-hmm. expand. But I did want to mention three different places in the Torah where it does mention the evil eye, not in the Torah itself, but in Genesis it mentions that when Sarah realized that she could not have a child and she wanted Abraham to have a child, she encouraged her servant Hagar to have a child with Abraham. And it's interesting that once she became pregnant, she taunted Sarah. And she said, look, you've lived with Abraham all these years and you've never been able to become pregnant. And I, in one night, have conceived. And you can imagine the distress of Sarah when this woman taunted her in this manner. And Rashi explains to us that Sarah was very hard on her and caused her to miscarry. And so you see that there is some kind of a psychological factor here that perhaps because Sarah meant, you know, Sarah got to her, that it caused her to miscarry. And then it tells us also, if you've been following the weekly portion, that when the sons of Jacob came down to buy food in Egypt, they were big, strapping, strong fellows, and they each entered into a different gate when they came into Egypt. And Rashi once more explains to us that this was to prevent them from receiving the evil eye, because I would imagine if they all came in at the very same time through the very same gate, they probably stopped traffic and everybody turned around and look at them and wonder who they were. And when they inquired and found out that perhaps they were all from the same family, perhaps people would speak about them, which would cause them, you know, to infer upon them an evil eye. And lastly, if any of you remember in the prophets, there's the story of David, who was told not to count the Jews, because in counting the Jews, he perhaps would bring a plague upon them. And this one is kind of an interesting one, because I guess that what would happen here is a situation where the Jews would consider their strength and their might, and it would kind of cause them to become very arrogant when they considered the numbers of Jews and how powerful they were. So those are three different incidents in which the Ayin Hara is mentioned, one in the prophets per se, and two in the Medrash, right? Medrash on the Torah. Okay, let me clarify that. The Medrash on the Torah. It's not Rashi that says about Hagar. Rashi brings in a Medrash. Okay. But the idea of evil eye is not mentioned anywhere in the Torah, as I mentioned before, because that would imply that there is another force that's capable of judging the world, and we know that simply cannot be. Okay, guys.
Okay, we've got a question from Mrs. Gail Ledford.
Okay.
And she will state her question, and then I'll put you back on hold, and we'll bring the volume back up.
Okay.
Are you hearing any popping on your end when we switch out?
No, I'm fine.
Okay, good deal. Here she is. Hey, you're an old pro at this.
isn't the concept of using the red bows to ward off the evil spirit, or even the concept of an evil spirit, contradictory to what you said, that there is no other force besides God?
There is no other, and that's the point that I'm making, that unfortunately people in our society have no way of explaining things that happen to them, and so they attribute it to some kind of a mystical force that exists in the world, which is absolutely not true. But because, like in primitive societies, when they look for a reason and they invent all sorts of spirits and animalism and things of this nature, this is what the ignorant person does. They literally, and I know this for a fact, I mean, we fight this misconception all the time. People literally believe that this is a force, that people are capable of zapping another person with. And this is absolutely not true, because we know that reward and punishment is God's and God's alone. And we say this in our prayers, and we know this to be true. And unfortunately, people that have limited knowledge think that I mean it's absolutely sickening to see that, you know, we have people that walk around with little bands of red ribbons which they believe is going to ward off some mysterious force in this world. The whole thing is utter stupidity.
Okay.
It's a denial of God. That's what it is.
All right. Well, see, this is the, I think that we here, when we finally got this teaching from Judaism about the providence of God and the idea of Satan just simply being an angel that is, his purpose is to tempt people, I think it brings everything into perspective. It did for me, and I don't know about everybody else. It, that put God in absolute control.
That's right. That's right. Well, that's really the essence of this, and that's what, something that we of course believe and maintain to be true. And when you think about the stupidity of it, it's really ludicrous.
Mm-hmm. All right. Has anybody else got anything? Jim, you got a midrash on this? Jim doesn't have a midrash. Anybody else? Well, I guess that will conclude it for this go-round.